Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Mona Simpson, whose latest novel is My Hollywood. Earlier novels, Anywhere But Here, The Lost Father, A Regular Guy, and Off Keck Road. Mona Simpson's latest novel is her first in 10 years. It's an upstairs-downstairs kind of novel. It takes place in Los Angeles from 1990, I think, until 2001. And concerns the relationship of a Filipina nanny and the wife of a comedy writer on television. And, of course, immediately in looking at that, I thought of two things. First, Rob and Laura Petrie from The Dick Van Dyke Show, and I noticed that there is a sound out to Dick Van Dyke in there. And the other, of course, Mona Simpson, is the fact that you were married to Richard Appel, who was a comedy writer, quit being a prosecutor and became a comedy writer for The Simpsons.
Yes, and who now runs The Cleveland Show, but also worked for a long time at The Simpsons and then King of the Hill and a couple shows in between.
So in a sense, as with Anywhere But Here, the starting point, I guess, is autobiography, and then it just goes off.
I think in this one, there's kind of autobiography all over the place, but not always visible. Like, I think the demographics of, it's about two women, this nanny and this struggling mom, a first-time mom who's got a lot of insecurity. The demographics of the first-time mom are similar to me. She's a white American woman. She works. She is having a child for the first time. I did that once. I now have two of them. But so that all kind of matched my life. In some ways, the internal workings of Lola were a bit more from my real life in a certain sense. I don't know. There's a little story I tell, which is that I grew up half my life in Los Angeles from the time I was about 12 on. And my mom supported us. She was a single working mom. And she would have said she worked because she had to, which was true. She was a speech therapist, and she worked with a lot of kids who had various problems talking. But she worked with one kid in particular who probably, if he were of our generation of kids, would have some sort of a diagnosis. He was very energetic and hard to manage and mischievous to the extreme. And sometimes when the parents went away, she would stay the weekend in their house because really she was the only person who could seem to calm him down and control him to any extent. So because I was her kid, I moved in too. And when we came to the house, the parents would leave. They'd go for their weekend. The housekeeper, who didn't speak any English, would flee the minute we were in the house with glee that someone else was taking the reins. And there we'd be for a weekend with these completely unmanageable kids. They would run away. They would hide. They would throw eggs in the pool. They would throw eggs at the ceiling. They would track mud in the house. They could not be contained. I mean, we spent most of our time chasing them. And then usually we'd catch them for a little bit and get them in a room. But it didn't last. And then at the end, I remember when the parents would come home, we'd have lost them once. Or one time, we literally didn't have them, and the parents were coming home. We heard the gravel come up the driveway, and we thought, now we've really done it. You know, we've gotten in terrible trouble. And as soon as the door banged open, like the kids materialized, there they were, standing politely, holding our hands. And they didn't tell, and we didn't tell. So in a way, I had that experience of being kind of a caregiver or a helper.
So that was in the back of your mind. And then when you moved to Los Angeles with your husband,
I had a little baby.
Then you began going to the park in Santa Monica, and you met all the nannies.
And they sort of segregated themselves according to, really to language, you know, to nationality, but less nationality and more to language.
And were you kind of hanging out then with the Filipino?
With the Filipinas, because they spoke English. The nannies tended to divide themselves in Los Angeles with Spanish-speaking and English-speaking.
And at that particular time, were you writing The Lost Father?
No, I was writing Off Keck Road.
But in the back of your mind, you began thinking about this?
No, really, this book started with their voices. I was just very enchanted by their sort of half-English exuberance.
You've said that you started the book just thinking about children and nannies, and the character of Claire, I guess, would have come later.
Well, it's funny, because you'd think that that would have been the easiest for me. I had the Lola part of the book finished years before. I mean, I tinkered with it a lot, so I shouldn't say that. But the essential bones of the Lola story I had finished at least 5 years before I turned the book in. I really struggled with Claire, and I also really struggled with Lola's voice went through a couple iterations. It was when I first started, it was, and I'd published some sections of the book, which were kind of richer in dialect and more vocal in a certain way. It was more thick and laden and vocal. And then after a while, I came to think that, I don't know, I speak a little bit of two other languages, not too well, but I realize when I'm speaking in another language, when I come to something complicated, what I do, because I'm not a fluent speaker, is I immediately transfer back and translate in English. And I think in English, even when I'm speaking in French or in my rudimentary Arabic. That's how I think. And the more sophisticated, complicated thoughts are all in English for me. And I realized that that would be the case for Lola. So I segregated her. I changed the timbre of her language in the narration and distinguished it from the scenes where she's actually talking.
In terms of creating voice, the voice of Claire could just as easily be your voice, but the voice of Lola has to be realistic, yet it also has to be readable for us. In other words, if you go overboard and create too much patois, it becomes difficult and we can't follow it.
And also, in a way, there's something unnatural. I came to feel there was something maybe even wrong about putting too much patois in the character's internal life, because we don't think in patois. None of us do. We don't think in stilted French. We think in English, and then we speak in stilted French. So I really did distinguish the speaking from her internal thinking. You know, she's in the States for quite a few years. So I wanted her English actually to grow and become more fluent as the book moves. So I also put that in. You know, one could easily read the book and not notice that, but I wanted it to be there.
There's also interspersed with that, of course, her conversations with other Filipinas who have come to the States at different times.
Yes.
So you've got that as well.
And different stages, both of the linguistically, but also there's a class difference not only between the various moms who employ nannies. We're in a generation where it used to be, of course, when I was growing up, no one had nannies. I didn't know anyone who had a nanny. And if we had a babysitter, it was a girl from down the street who was being paid by the hour for a couple hours and not paid probably more than a quarter an hour. At that time, only the very wealthy had domestic help. But now, because women went to college and decided we were going to work and have been doing so or trying to do so, now we have this vast pool of middle-class families who have children under school age, and there's really no affordable or reasonable or good, cheerful, promising daycare. So every couple who both work and who have a child under six really has to contend with this problem in one way or another, either by daycare or something.
And as you point out, for a lot of these women, for example, whatever money they earn is going to be equivalent to what they're giving the nanny anyway.
Could be. I mean, yeah. I've met nannies in Los Angeles who make more than UCLA professors.
At the same time as you were writing the book, your own marriage was crumbling. And
well, about mine, I can't really say anything except that we're good friends. And he wrote in his, he recently went to his college reunion and wrote in it something to the effect of he wants to be the couple that young couples look to when they get married and think that someday maybe we can have their divorce. It's useful to have a comedy writer in the family. But in terms of Claire and Paul's marriage, I wanted it to be not a great passion, not a terrible marriage, not a great marriage, sort of like most marriages, somewhere in between. And I wanted Lola, in fact, who comes and helps them, to in many ways keep them together. And I wanted her to be a sort of silent, invisible force in the family that in a way allowed them to accept each other's limitations and forgive each other. And then when she is no longer a strong part of their lives, things became harder for them.
Do you think that if you had had a Lola, it could have changed things?
There are a few Lolas in the world. She's a fictional character.
Mona Simpson, I want to broaden the discussion a little bit because as I was reading the book, a lot of political and social ideas began coming up, one of which is, and I guess I got this more in the first half of the book than the second, I found Claire to be spoiled, entitled, and narcissistic. She didn't pay much attention to Lola, who was actually doing the real work, and she seemed so concerned with herself that she didn't seem to notice what was going on. And I wonder if that's just Claire or if there's something going on in the American psyche that we can look at for that.
I certainly worked to make her limited, but I didn't think of her as probably quite as entitled and narcissistic as you thought. I mean, I thought of her as primarily a woman who needed to and wanted to work much the same way that her husband did. I mean, I guess you could say they're both spoiled and narcissistic. I hope yours is an extreme reaction, because I don't want people to see them as terrible people. I don't think that every couple who hire a nanny, even though the very act of having a nanny is a complicated thing to do, I don't think it necessarily is a response to being spoiled. I really think there are very few alternatives. It's sort of like private school. Are you spoiled if you send your kids to private school? Well, in a certain way, yes. But in other ways, no. Not when we, as a culture, haven't provided alternatives, because no one really wants to make a political point with their child.
That's why I said the first half of the book. The second half of the book, that changes. But there is that line that I believe the character of Paul says to his friend Jeff about Lola when it looks like they're about to can her. You can have her. And Lola overhears this.
Oh, yeah.
And she's being passed around as if she's an object.
As if she's a package in a table. Yeah. And she even, that metaphor is continued. And they actually do propose that the other couple take her. Well, I think it's an interesting question of whether, I mean, one of the issues I was really probing in this book is, can love be something that is bought and sold, and can it be commodified and enter the marketplace? There's a joke Lola makes about nannies are the second oldest profession. Men hire women for sex and women hire women for childcare. But I think that there's a way in which that question is really the heart of the book. The answers can sometimes be disturbing too.
The idea that Lola or these other nannies are going to love the children, I believe you said this at one point, you're part of the family until we fire you.
One of the fun things about research is that I worked on this book for such a long time that one of my friends actually found this contract.
Oh, which the contract's amazing. That's a real contract?
I mean, I modified it, of course, but it came to me as a real contract that one couple had given to another couple. I'll just read a little bit of it, because it almost reads as comedy. At the very end of the contract, it says, Wanda's employment under this agreement may be terminated upon one or more of the following events: by the Gelfonds, those are her employers, for justifiable cause with 24 hours notice. In this case, Wanda will not receive any outstanding payment for sick or vacation days. The Gelfonds can justifiably terminate Wanda for the following reasons. 1. Wanda fails to comply with the rules and standards established by the Gelfonds. 2. Wanda engages in fraud, dishonesty, or any act of misconduct. B. By the Gelfonds, so they can terminate the contract without cause upon 2 weeks' notice, in lieu of 2 weeks' notice, 2 weeks' salary. If she's done nothing wrong, they can fire her today and say, get out, but here's 2 weeks' salary, or they can pay her for 2 weeks. By Wanda, she can terminate the contract upon 6 weeks' notice. So she has to give them 6 weeks' notice. They can give her 2 weeks' notice or a day's notice if they pay her for 2 weeks. And then it will also be terminated by her permanent disability. And then it goes on to say the terms of this agreement shall commence, blah, 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 blah. And then the last line of the contract, and this came straight from life, we look forward to you being a part of our family for many years to come.
Very, very bizarre. There's a book that Lola's friend slash landlord has, Ruth's book, which contains letters and comments from nannies over a period of 30 years. I understand that you received from the Department of Labor letters, and I would guess that they kind of went into that book.
One of them did, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, and I also read a lot of manuals, which were lots of fun to read. There was one or two agency heads who were writing for immigrants both now and in the past 50 years looking for employment here, how to be employed in a domestic job, and, you know, kinds of advice like do not eat curry and brush your teeth 5 times a day. And then also some were targeted to women who were hiring help. I did a lot of kinds of research for that.
When you were done with your research and when you were writing it, did you become more impassioned about the role of the nanny in domestic help? Did it change you in terms of how you viewed it? Because as I'm reading the book, you know, it changes me, it just in the sense of we who are upstairs often ignore those who are downstairs.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, in terms of that, you wrote a piece in July in the New York Times in which you talked about changing the laws on domestic help in order that people pay taxes and so on. But this is also problematic as well, right?
It's very problematic. I mean, I think when Roosevelt passed the New Deal legislation, domestic workers were one of the few groups excluded from those rights and protections. Actually, the letters from the Department of Labor, many of them were in response to that and begging, pleading, opining about how hard it was and asking to be included. And really, they were like wishes on stars or letters sent in bottles into the ocean, because here, more than 50 years later, still domestic workers don't have those rights and protections. And part of that is that it is hard to control that in the same way. It's hard to legislate. Even if the law, there is legislation pending in New York that would impose certain limitations in the hours and require overtime pay and vacation pay and the normal stipulations. However, just imagine how that would actually be taken into effect. I mean, most of the people, or many of the people who would be complaining, would also be illegal aliens. And imagine how they're going to go and complain. Will they feel comfortable that they won't be deported? I don't know. So, I mean, I think the legislation must pass, and it's a good first step, but I don't know that it will immediately solve the problem.
You're listening to an interview with Mona Simpson, whose latest novel is My Hollywood. You have a character named Candace, who's also known as the Slave. And is that a fictional character or somebody that you either met or spoke with?
She's a fictional character, although I did a lot of research. There's been a number of cases of slavery of that kind in America. It's not usually the case of Americans getting a foreign slave. It's usually immigrants of one kind or another bringing in a poor woman from their own country and keeping her passport and claiming that she needs to pay off her wages, which, of course, is a futile and hopeless task.
Well, in this particular case, we have someone who's been beaten and can't complain.
Who's sleeping in the garage with most of the dogs, one of the dogs who's allowed to sleep in the house.
Now, the character of Ruth kind of sits in the background. She came to America, and she kind of runs a under-the-table agency, is the way I can figure. Is that about right?
Yes. She doesn't really take a fee. She had a situation where she was working for a couple for a long time, and then they felt that she was too attached to their son. And they then gave her some money because she'd worked for them for a long time, and she bought a large apartment with that money, which she lives in now, and she turned it into a sort of boarding house for recent immigrants who work at these nannying jobs, at these live-in jobs, but they're usually off one or two days a week, and so they can have a bunk bed and a dresser to keep their things in her place.
Is that based on anyone?
Yes. I met a woman who did do that.
From the point of view of Lola, the domestic, the nanny here, she doesn't do any ironing. And that becomes a key issue in that if someone is hired as a nanny, they're also told, hey, you, get me the tea. I mean, they become the servant. They become the maid, even though they're hired for a different function. And they have nothing to say because they could be terminated immediately.
There's a woman who called into a radio show I was on who said she had worked as a nanny in her 20s while she was going to graduate school. And it actually was a great job for her. And she wanted to become a teacher. But when she became a teacher, she had a huge drop in salary. But she did it for the status. Really, a nanny's only way of not being treated in that way is to quit. And many nannies do if they have the power to get another job.
You also talk about the class consciousness among the Filipinas. For instance, one of the women there is studying to be a doctor, and yet she's a nanny at the same time. And how common is that?
Quite common. The nanny I kind of based this voice on, she never worked for me, but I knew her from the park. Then later on, she introduced me to her employer, who was a Shakespeare professor, who I got to know as well. She only worked for that family briefly. They were both professors, and they only needed a nanny until he was old enough for preschool. But her sister was also here. She had five kids like Lola in the Philippines, and her sister was here, a doctor. She's working even now. Her sister is still in L.A. as a doctor. Now, in fairness, the model was from an educated family, and she has done exceedingly well as a nanny. She's now living in London and Paris with a very prominent movie director. She was able to really get many great jobs. She was not ironing, I'm sure. I think there are class differences, but it's only due to the disaster of the economy in the Philippines. I did a little piece for NPR because when the immigration thing was going strong, there's a way in which I did all the calculations. It's as if, say you make $70,000 here, and say somebody across the world offered you over $500,000 to work 5 days doing something you know how to do, and you can easily do. It may not be stimulating to you. It may not be using your full soul, but you're able to pay for your kids' college. And then let's say the other 2 days that you're not working, you could get a weekend job, which would pay even more than that. So you could end up making 10 times what you earn here.
In dealing with the alternating chapters, I think there's a tendency when dealing with the Lola character to almost make her too much of a saint. Did you notice that there could be a problem and try to ensure?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing I didn't want to do in this book is I didn't want the mom to be a narcissistic upper-class woman. She's actually not. She's a middle-class woman who loves what she does and wants to work. That's really why she has a helper. I didn't want the nanny to be some warm, wise, folksy person from another country who's going to impart wisdom and then melt into the sky.
You worked hard to ensure that that didn't happen.
I tried to.
You think you succeeded?
I think so. I'm worried that you felt that Claire was so narcissistic. I didn't mean her to be. I feel like, do we think that the man in couples who hire a nanny is spoiled and entitled?
Oh, I thought the men were horrible.
Oh, okay. On the other hand, what is a couple to do? You know, both want to work or both need to work. In many families now, both people need to work. And they have a young child. In some communities, there's great home daycare, and in many, there isn't. We certainly lag behind our European counterparts in good daycare and preschool programs.
And this is a broader issue for me. You know, as I watch the news, I see just this general white American entitlement coming down. I mean, we see it from the Tea Party people who think they're entitled to the government's largesse when it comes to Social Security and Medicare.
But don't want to pay in.
But don't want to pay in and trash everyone else. And we see it all up and down the line from people on the left, people on the right. Lola's attitude, for instance, toward romance is you marry a guy because it's going to work for you, which if you like him and love him, great. Well, you have to like him. But that's as far as it goes.
Right.
Whereas this idealism, this entitlement.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, I think one of the reasons the status of a nanny is dubious or is complicated is because it goes beyond just nannies. I mean, I think traditionally women have worked in nursing, in teaching as librarians, and those are classically underpaid sources of income. And I think there is a way in which, I know there have been books written by sociologists, that there's a hesitance on our part to sort of professionalize vocations which we like to think of as vocations, as work that comes from the heart, is something that's done for love. We want to feel that our teachers are teaching our children because they love children, they have a gift with children, and nannies love children and have a gift with children. The same with librarians and nurses. And while those things are true, they're also working people who need a living and who are supporting others. So I think really in many ways the answer is to professionalize this work.
That also means, Mona Simpson, professionalizing in a way what people have been trying to do, even the role of the stay-at-home mother.
Yes, of course. That's the source of it as well. It's an interesting question, too, because, I mean, men of our generation tend to work much more than their fathers in terms of hours per week. I think I've read statistics, I think it's 18 to 20 more hours a week than equivalent men in their fathers' generations. Many women in our generation work, and you still can't get the phone company to come to your house except between 9 and 5. And we still have children, and we still do not have public daycare options. So really, the culture is full of contradictions and paradoxes in all this realm. And I mean, why aren't we struggling with this more? If it was a job 20 years ago to raise children and run a home and direct their school lives, and if women are now working full-time, what does it mean about what we think of those activities? Do we respect them? Are we supposed to be able to do them in our coffee breaks? I mean, how does this parse?
Claire has a flaky mother. There seems to be a flaky mother syndrome running through your books, but from what I understand, you didn't have a flaky mother.
There's flaky and there's flaky. My mother did a pretty good job, actually. She would not have chosen to work. And she did work probably that she was trained to do, but it wasn't her first love. She would have probably liked to be a designer of some sort. But it was interesting for me as a kid growing up. So my mother was working because she had to. She would have preferred to be married, and she had been married. She was divorced. She would have preferred to, you know, have parties and be a stay-at-home mom. But also, she was working at a job that probably wasn't her first-choice job. But even with all that, I watched her derive a great deal of satisfaction from her work. She started out working with children as a speech therapist, but she ended up working with stroke victims and teaching them to talk again after they'd had strokes. And she was gifted at it, and I saw her really get a great deal of pleasure and satisfaction from her work, even though it wasn't what she would have chosen. And by the way, that's in the book, too, because, I mean, we're sort of critical in a quick way with Paul and Claire for working and handing off the childcare. But many of these nannies are making the same decision in many ways. They're deciding that they will come here and make money and send it home to their children.
And send it home maybe even to a nanny.
That too, yes, because in the book there are many, and I did a lot of research, there's many cases where there is a nanny raising the kids back home, because the husband also will be elsewhere working, not as a nanny, but as an engineer or something, as a construction worker. One of the nannies I interviewed for the book works here. She was trained as a nurse in the Philippines, but here she's a nanny, even though her employers joke around because they say she's a great nanny. The only thing is she's not good with kids. She runs their lives. And her husband is a head contractor in Israel. So they'd been sending money home to the Philippines all these years. And a yaya, who had actually was the daughter of someone who'd helped raise the mother, was taking care of them.
The reason I mentioned flaky mothers, and knowing that your mother isn't flaky, that we've got in Anywhere But Here flaky mother.
Yes.
We've got Claire's flaky mother.
I certainly wouldn't deny the existence of some insanity in my family. But I wanted this mother, Claire, to be, as you point out, she's more inept. I don't know about inept. She's more flustered and thrown by having a baby than probably the average mother. And I wanted that to be the case because I thought that her need for Lola was greater. If you had a great model for a mother and maybe an older sister who was really good at this too, you could probably negotiate, even with working, even with all of it, you could probably do so more gracefully.
So you wanted
I wanted to heighten the drama.
And you wanted to kind of push her into a little box where she had no way out other than Lola.
Not that she had no way out, but I wanted her to need Lola and be open to impress in a way that not everyone would have been.
And you make her a musician, which means you had to do research on musicians. And obviously, if you made her a writer, people would be making parallels that wouldn't exist. So it's obvious you wanted a different profession. Why music, and what kind of research did you do?
Oh, I played viola for much of my young
really?
Life. But I did a lot of research. I talked to a couple composers, which was a lot of fun. But I wanted it to be something that worked at home, because I was sort of just looking around at the other couples in my kids' class. And if both people are doctors, there's sort of no choice. If you're a mom and a doctor, you either quit, you know, many women do, or you don't. You really do have to do one or the other. Whereas it's a little more complicated for men and women. I've seen this also when the man is the person who has more flexible hours. If you're self-employed, it's more complicated.
Mona Simpson, your website contains outtakes from the book. Why'd you do that?
That's a good question. I liked that outtake.
Why did you remove it from the book?
I thought it perhaps just wandered a little too far from the central narrative. I thought it would be fun on the website. I don't know. Writers are supposed to have websites now. So I thought if somebody's going to take the trouble to go to your website, you want to put a little something there that you couldn't just find ordinarily.
And you did go to the Philippines.
I did. We see Lola's home back in the Philippines at the end of the book. And I just wanted to make sure that what I had imagined was more or less correct or plausible. And there were a few things I did change. It's a pretty small scene in the Philippines, so I probably experienced a lot more. I happened to be there at a time that one of the nannies I'd known in the park, who'd since stopped being a nanny, but she now was a stay-at-home mom in the States, and she had two children, and she was back there with her children. I knew various nannies here in the States. Several of them had given me things to deliver. So she took me to their houses, and I was struck by the class differences among them.
They're in the same class here, but there, some are poor, some are wealthy.
Yeah. I mean, it's like when we go to college here. You know, you're all in a dorm together, but somebody might go home for Thanksgiving to a mansion, and somebody might go home to two rooms above a convenience store.
Mona Simpson, why did you call the book My Hollywood?
I like the title because it seemed like a sort of glamorous memoir, and I thought of it as kind of Lola's memoir of her years in Hollywood.
And your own involvement with Hollywood, certainly Richard Appel named Homer Simpson's mom after Mona Simpson. Was
yes.
that long in the works, or did he just suddenly said, I'm naming Glenn Close's character
after you?
No.
What happened, it's funny too, because we were at the preschool at one point, they called us in and asked for a donation of an extraordinary amount of money, which we not only did not have, but would not have in our lifetimes. And, you know, it was the kind of thing that made us do a spit take. And we said, well, why would you think we had that much money? And they said, well, we just assumed you work for the Simpsons and your wife's name is Simpson. They'd assumed that he created the Simpsons. Now, what happened is it was the first show he wrote for the Simpsons. He just started writing for the Simpsons, which was his first job in TV comedy. And he looked through the archives and realized that Homer's mother had never been chronicled, although Homer's father had been. So he created a history for Homer's mother, which was about a lost parent coming back. And my second book had been a little bit about that. So he just thought, oh, let's name her Mona Simpson.
Your other dealing with Hollywood is Anywhere But Here. Did you have any work on the movie at all? Or?
I did a little bit. It was directed by Wayne Wang, who lives up here, and written by Alvin Sargent, who lives in Santa Monica as well. And they would sometimes stop by my little office and ask me questions. As I learned later on, they invited me to a screening, and there were a few things that I said, oh, no, no, they have to be taken out. And they said that, well, in fact, those things got good audience approval from the testing audience. So I realized that I might have thoughts all I wanted, but it didn't matter. So I was involved in a kind of fun way, but not a significant way.
Are you happy with the film?
I don't know if any writer is completely happy with a film made of their book.
IMDb has you listed as writing an episode of a show called The Hidden Room. Is that for real? Or
no. The Hidden Room may be an adaptation of a short story called Lawns, which I wrote, that was made into a film for television. I'm not sure, but I didn't write it.
Okay.
I wrote the short story.
Mona Simpson, I understand you're working on two different stories. One is about amateur detectives and dogs, and the other is about Syrian marriages in the U.S.
Yes, that's true. I'm mostly working on the first one, which is about two teenage boys who are sort of amateur snoops and end up sort of seeing something and discovering something they wished that was a lot more serious than anything they'd intended. Then the second one I'm just anecdotally researching, which is, well, I've got a lot of diaspora Syrian cousins. Many of them had arranged marriages. A few did not. Although when I say arranged marriage, it's not what we would think of as an arranged marriage. I'll give you an example. One of my cousins came here when she was about 20. She was in college. Her brothers were all here. And her family would locate a young man for her. Invariably, he was a young doctor, some sort of Arab young doctor, and they would arrange a meeting. Usually they would fly to where he was. And all of her brothers, her mother would come over, her father was dead, and they would all meet. So maybe seven people would fly, say, to Case Western, where the fellow was in medical school. His family would all be there. They'd spend a weekend. The young people would be given time to take walks and maybe even have a meal together, but most of it would be both families. On Sunday, they flew back to California. Sunday night, she told her eldest brother, nah, he's too short. So my oldest cousin would call the family and say, it will not go forward. That's all that was said, and then the next fellow would be contacted.
Mona Simpson, the book about the young detectives, is that going to be a young adult novel?
No. It's mostly about the adults in it, but it's sort of through the lens of these boys and what they discover.
One final question on My Hollywood. There's a huge bibliography on your website of
yes.
books that you researched. What I get from you, from the book and from talking to you, is there's a lot of ambiguity. It's like this is a problem that's almost insoluble.
I don't want to say that, though, because even though that, on the deepest level, I think that's true, but I think that too many liberals, of which I'm one, get lost in the complexities and then we don't do anything. And in fact, there are certain things which are absolutely solvable and, you know, there should be legislation. It should be much, much harder to pay domestic workers off the books. It should be much, much easier in doing that little op-ed piece for the Times. I did some research, and I can't tell you how many people told me they went to their accountants, they tried to pay their housekeeper on the books, and it became a nightmare. It became impossible. The paperwork, it's completely unnecessarily complicated and difficult. Certainly, there has to be overtime protection. There has to be mandatory sick days. So, I mean, while that won't solve all the problems, just the way that, you know, I think teachers right now have a better situation probably than nannies, do we feel the teachers are treated the way that we wish they were? No. You know, there's much to be done, but that doesn't mean that nothing can be done.
And I guess a start would be creating a form to make it easy for people to actually do that.
Yes, and to create some standards, some ethical and moral standards. I mean, you know, there's all these bumper stickers that say, my daughter is an honor student at John Muir. Instead, it should be, you know, my nanny will have Social Security benefits when she's old. Will yours? It should become a matter of absolute moral necessity and legal necessity.
You've been listening to an interview with Mona Simpson, whose latest novel is My Hollywood. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.